50 years ago, our government drove the innovation that inspired the world and put Americans on the moon.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And on Monday, President Donald Trump met with 18 heads of U.S. technology companies. Some of them he'd met with before. His American Technology Council. And did you look carefully? I mean, is he in charge of them or are they in charge of him?
Today, many of our agencies rely on painfully outdated technology. And yet we have the greatest people in technology that the world has ever seen right here with us in this room.
It's clear that Trump remembers the moon landing better than Apple CEO Tim Cook, who was in first grade, or Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella, who wasn't born. CEO of Amazon Jeff Bezos was three. He today plays with rockets of his own and buys grocery giants. He carted off Whole Foods for more than $13 billion last week.
You know, when we met before in December, I encouraged this administration that you could be the innovation administration.
Amazon has gone from the buy books with a click business in the 90s to selling virtually anything. It's an Oscar-winning movie studio, an online community. You can go on Amazon to hire workers. Yes, the largest internet-based retailer in the world, the fourth most valuable company in the world, and the eighth largest employer in the U.S. It sells jobs, rents space in the cloud, and it wants to sell you carrots. Amazon, you see, is big.
I wish I was big!
Oh my God. There's nothing I can wear. From where'd I get all this hair? I've gotten big!
You can tell Jeff Bezos is never much worried about hair. His signature bald pate is from Central Casting, though. The android-like CEO controller of the benign, infinitely large company, preferably American.
Everything you need to be happy. Your day is very important to us.
B is for by and large, your very best friend.
Disney, another giant company with designs on permanently renting part of your mind, has thought a lot about the 21st century concept of hugeness. This hour, we have a look at the crossroads of bigness, wealth, and media technology, and economic justice. Do they go together? Can they live together? Stacey Mitchell is the co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and the author of the report Amazon Stranglehold. And James Marcus worked at Amazon for 5 years between 1996 and 2001. He's editor at Harper's Magazine and author of Amazonia, 5 years at the epicenter of the dot-com juggernaut. Welcome to both of you, Stacey and James.
Thanks for having
Hello.
Me.
Hello.
So what do you think the secret is to Amazon's growth and how it's managed to come about kind of quietly?
Well, I'm not sure how quiet it really is. I mean, I started at Amazon in 1996 at a time when it was only a bookstore, and it was a tiny company. I was, you know, the 55th or 57th employee there. But even before I started the job, while I was being interviewed for the job, it was clear to me that this gospel of expansionism was very important to Jeff Bezos' vision of the company, and that while books was a great sort of entering wedge in the brand new world of online retail, that he intended to sell everything.
That was clear in the mid-90s.
Even while you were interviewing for a job there, there was this riff you heard that if you wanted to buy a kayak, not an item that was sold by Amazon then, you could eventually buy a kayak there, but you could book your travel to go kayak somewhere and you could be put in touch with other fellow kayakers. He saw it as a hub to sell every conceivable good and service from the very beginning.
Amazon has become this very sticky force in our lives. It's been very skilled at luring us into its ecosystem and really locking us in. One of the ways that it did that for years and still does is through a kind of loss leading strategy where it will sell an entire category of goods like books at a loss in order to put out competitors in that sector and bring us into its ecosystem.
I mean, if Bezos had this idea that you can sell everything online, what are the unintended consequences of something being that big? Because it's also true that Amazon gets enormous profit from renting the cloud out, if you see it in its annual reports. Its share of jobs is absolutely huge.
We often talk about Amazon as though it's a retailer, but I don't think that's actually how Amazon sees itself. Amazon really wants to control the basic infrastructure of commerce. It wants to own the online platform through which we buy and sell goods. It wants to own the cloud. It now controls a third of all cloud computing capacity in the world, and it's increasingly building out the infrastructure to do shipping and package delivery. The idea that Amazon has in mind is that by controlling this basic infrastructure, it will be kind of the gatekeeper through which all other companies have to go if they want to sell goods online, if they want to use data in the cloud, if they want to ship things to our doorsteps. And the consequence of that is that Amazon now essentially has privatized the market. It would be as if Walmart came into your community and not only had a giant store there that sold a lot of goods, but also bought up all of the real estate and then became the gatekeeper and determined which other businesses get to have a good spot on Main Street, who gets to sell there under what terms. And that's really what's happened with Amazon's platform. They're now capturing one out of every $2 that Americans spend online. And if you're a producer of goods, a manufacturer of any size, if you're a competing retailer, you now face this really Faustian choice. Do you continue to hang your shingle out on a road that's not very well traveled, that is search engines, or do you give in and become a seller on Amazon's platform? And more companies are finding that that's the only way they can reach customers, but it's very perilous because your Amazon manipulates those markets and uses its power as a gatekeeper to undermine its competitors.
Let's take a look at American history. In industrial growth in the past, there have been certain triggers that caused governments to intervene, and we have this whole antitrust law that has built up around that. It seemed to me that the kinds of things that an auto producer would do around the 1920s that would get the government very, very worried is buy up a steel company. So if the auto company also owned the steel company, that was really concerning to the government, and we created laws to stop that. But Amazon buys Whole Foods, and everyone kind of goes, oh, that's really clever. That's so clever. But what if they bought FedEx tomorrow?
Which they might. I mean, the thing is that there, as you point out, there was an era when that sort of vertical integration was seen as a trigger for antitrust investigation. But there was a big sea change in antitrust policy and enforcement during the Reagan era. Prior to that, a lot of the focus of antitrust had been on breaking up monopolies. But during the Reagan era, the emphasis shifted over to the consumer. And protecting the consumer meant primarily delivering low prices. And so that attitude has been very much to Amazon's advantage, and it has, I think, kept us from being as anxious as we should be about its centralization of so many different parts of the economy.
If your brand identity is benign, Stacey, does that conceal all evil and that whatever the government says, if people love you, then you could do whatever you want with them? You know, freedom kind of goes out the window.
I think we're foolish if we imagine that this kind of centralization of power is going to serve anyone's interests in the long run but Amazon's. You know, our anti-monopoly policies for many decades were broad in the sense that they were concerned not only about our welfare as consumers, but also about the potential of a powerful company overwhelming government, also concerned about our welfare as workers and producers, as small business people. Antitrust used to be as much about liberty as anything else in this sense that you ought to be able to have a fair market where you could go out and ply your trade and be able to compete on a fair playing field. And Amazon has really, it has used this shift in antitrust law that is focused so heavily on consumers to its advantage to come in and consolidate and control much of the commerce that is online now and now increasingly moving into the physical world. And we have been very flat-footed in recognizing what's at stake because of those changes that were made under Ronald Reagan to the antitrust policies.
But 5 years ago, everyone would say Walmart is the big evil. Walmart is the big evil. Now Amazon is taking on Walmart. Well, hey, great. So you left who were mad at Walmart, you know, now you got somebody that's going after Walmart. Now you got to be happy.
But I don't think it's a lefty objection. I think it's wanting to maintain a sort of healthy economic ecosystem in many parts of the economy. I think, to me, it is inherently dangerous to centralize too much in one player. We may get a lower price on Garden Hose or Raisin Bran, but I think we forfeit something important by letting one player dominate so much.
Stacey?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to think about this, you know, even from our own self-interest. You know, Amazon is destroying the ecology of industries. When we wrote this report that we produced last fall, we interviewed a wide range of manufacturers, and what they all told us is that the prospect of having this one company that is a gatekeeper, where it's very difficult to introduce a new product. You know, Amazon is great for search, but it's not great for discovery. And what these companies all talked about was that the independent brick and mortar stores, the sort of diversity of the marketplace was so critical for a new author or a newly developed toy or a new product to be able to get out there in the marketplace and find an audience. And they're sort of terrified of this prospect of that ecology being destroyed. As consumers, that's going to mean less diversity in the marketplace. And we should be also be mindful that Amazon is not only using its power and all of the data that it collects to manipulate competition, but it's also manipulating us as consumers. Amazon, you know, we've been sort of lulled into the ease and convenience of this to the point that now a majority of people, when they want to buy something online, they don't start at a search engine. They just start at Amazon's website right off.
I mean, that leads to the really key question is bigness in terms of Amazon, bigness in terms of Facebook, bigness in terms of Google. What do you think the ecosystem is with Facebook, Amazon, and Google? Is it competitory? Do they hate each other? Do they love each other? Is one the Ministry of Information? Is the other the Ministry of Raisin Bran?
There's a lot at stake in this consolidation of power and online platforms for the public interest. And I think we really need to step back and take a good look at what's at stake here. You know, we've dealt with these kinds of issues in different ways in the past. You know, a century ago, we dealt with this in railroads. You know, the people who first owned the railroads used that power to discriminate against other companies that wanted to reach the market. There was a lot of cross-ownership. If you owned a mill or a steel company or something, you also bought a railroad, and then you could prevent your competitors from being able to use those lines, or you could charge them higher prices. This is essentially what Amazon is now doing online with its platform. And we developed a body of law that essentially said you are a common carrier, and therefore you have to treat everybody equally. And so when I think about these big platforms and their role, I'm beginning to think we need to look at this idea of public utility regulation. How do we ensure that we get the benefits of some of these innovations, but that we also account for competition and fairness in the market, and that we impose some appropriate rules on how these players operate?
Stacy Mitchell is co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and author of the report, Amazon Stranglehold. James Marcus is editor of Harper's Magazine, author of Amazonia, 5 years at the epicenter of the dot-com juggernaut. Stacy and James, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.